Lecture 7, The Buddhist Monastic Community.
In the last three lectures, we've been talking about the Buddha, first of all, by telling the story of the Buddha's life, and then beginning to dig a little bit into the categories of the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha's Dharma. When we do this, we're really taking our cue, actually, from a fundamental formula that's used in the Buddhist tradition to express faith in the tradition itself. It's called the Three Refuges. Some people have said that it functions in Buddhism a little bit like the Lord's Prayer or some other very common affirmation of faith does in other religious traditions. And it sounds simply like this. In English, you would say, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha, or the Buddha's community. These are the three focal points of faith in the Buddhist tradition. So people would recite as part of an ordinary daily ritual these three refuges, and for some people it is used as a formula when they want to assert that their own Buddhist identity. They say that they take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So obviously the next important issue for us to consider here in our discussion of Buddhism is the nature of the Sangha, or the community. We need to know something about how that community developed, what some of the issues were that affected its historical evolution, and how it's functioned as a bearer for the memory of the Buddha himself, and of course also as a vehicle for the expansion of his teaching. Now, at the very beginning, of course, the community was quite small and really consisted of just an informal band of followers wandering with the Buddha as he wandered the roads of northern India, visiting from town to town, teaching his Dharma, and gathering together a band of disciples and lay followers. It was a diverse community. It's often spoken of as having four parts: monks, nuns, the male and female members of the monastic community, and male and female lay supporters. So that you can ask yourself to start with, what are the basic roles, the basic types of people who would be found in a Buddhist community? And I think probably the best place to start, right at the very beginning, is with the role of the lay supporter, because obviously these monks and nuns can't really continue for very long unless they've got a lot of devoted lay people to support them. And when we talk about the lay supporter, obviously there are quite a few pretty good examples of lay supporters in the Buddhist tradition. I like to focus on a man by the name of Anattapindika, who is called a donor, a great donor in Pali and in Sanskrit also. A donor is called a Dhanapati, a lord of generosity. The word dana, of course, comes from the same root as our word donor. So a Dhanapati is a lord of generosity, somebody who makes generous donations. The story about Anattapindika is that he felt the community needed to have some kind of a place to live where they could set up shop and be able to teach in some kind of settled way to the community in which he lived. And there was a particularly desirable place out in territory that surrounded the town. He offered to buy it from its owner, and the man said, I wouldn't sell it to you unless it were paved with gold. And Anattapindika, according to the story, what would he do? We're here in the realm of the miraculous and the extraordinary. He paved it with gold. He spread gold coins across the ground and bought the land for the use of the Buddha's monastic followers. And I suppose you could say from that time to this, Anattapindika and other great donors like him have been models of generosity for the lay supporters of the community. Now, this is pretty obvious in a way. It's been pretty clear from what I've said about Buddhist monasticism that you couldn't have these monks unless there were a devoted band of generous lay followers to support them. But there are a couple of implications of this concept, of this practice, this image, that are perhaps worth considering. First of all, when we talked about the practice of the path last time, I told you that the five moral precepts of lay people were really rather negative virtues. Now, they're important virtues. It's important not to kill and steal and lie and all those things, but they involve really restraints on conduct. They don't allow you to do anything in a sense that positively asserts your concern for others or for your concern for the community. Now, you could get the impression from that, I suppose, that Buddhism is, again, largely a negative tradition in its discipline. It isn't, of course, and one way we see that, I think, is by considering very seriously this question of generosity. To be a good layperson is really to be generous, to donate as much as you can for the sustenance and support of the Sangha and for the preservation of the Dharma. In fact, you could probably say, I think this would be true, that generosity is in some respects the most basic form of lay meditation because it involves giving up, expressing concern for others in a way that allows you no longer to focus quite so much on yourself. So it is in some ways a very simple but very effective way to meditate on the basic fundamental value of no self. It also is interesting to note here, and this is just intriguing to ponder, I'd have to say, that it's one of the duties of a monk to give a lay person an opportunity to give. And you could see how in some kinds of situations you might caricature this as being with the image of a greedy monk who's constantly out asking for donations. There's some monks really who look like this in many situations. But the truth is they're acting out another important aspect of the Buddhist ideal. A lay person has the duty to give. How can a lay person give if there isn't a monk who is there at the door humbly receiving the donation that a lay person has to offer? So in this complicated system of a Buddhist institutional life, I suppose you could say it's as important to receive as it is to give others the opportunity to make the merit and to express their generosity by supporting the monastic community that you represent. So Anatta Pindika represents this important Buddhist ideal, the ideal of a generous lay donor, or Dhanapati. Another type of person we should consider is the nun, the organization of nuns, the community of nuns, who were a significant, important part of this early Buddhist community. The story about the formation of the community of nuns, I think to our eyes these days, is somewhat problematic. But I'll tell it to you anyway, and we can comment on it, ponder it together. The Buddha's aunt, Maha Prajapati, asked one of the Buddha's trusted followers if he would be willing to ordain her as a nun. Up until this time, he had only ordained men in his monastic organization. The Buddha initially refused, and she pressed him again and again, and finally he agreed to do it, but with a couple of restrictive stipulations. One was that the nuns would have to abide by an additional series of regulations over and above the regulations that applied to the monks. And another stipulation, perhaps troubling to us, was that even the most senior nun would be junior to the most junior monk. The monastic system is hierarchical based on age, and this meant that even the most senior nun would rank in the hierarchical system lower than the most newly ordained monk. Now, this tradition of nuns thrived in the early community and was an important part of the expansion of Buddhism on into Southeast Asia and into the rest of the world. There are now active communities of nuns, particularly in China, but the traditional practice of Buddhist nuns has died out now in Southeast Asia, although there are in some places attempts to reestablish that lineage. So if you want to study Buddhist nuns, it's probably easiest to look at that community in a traditional Chinese context, such as Taiwan, or in Tibet, where Buddhist nuns are active as well. What should we make about these additional stipulations that the Buddha imposed on this early community of nuns? Was he doing a good thing for Mahaprajapati by establishing this kind of community? I suppose it's difficult for us to judge, really, a historical phenomenon that operated or that developed in a time and in a context very different from our own. But I think we should probably say two things. One is that in its time, it seems this was quite radical to open up the possibility of renunciation in a formal context to women. So the possibility of monasticism for women has been an important part of the Buddhist community, and it represents, in a significant way, I think, a commitment to the possibility of nirvana and, as it were, full liberation for women within the community itself. So it's important not to caricature the early Buddhist tradition and in any way as derogatory or diminishing the ability of women to achieve enlightenment or awakening in the same way that the Buddha himself achieved it. But it is true, of course, that there have been these additional restrictions on the status that nuns can acquire in the Buddhist community that reflect, I suspect, us we would have to say in some way, the restrictions on the behavior and the status of women in the context, the time in which these regulations were made. In any case, nuns were an important part of the early community, and the monastic practice of women continues to be significant in the Buddhist community today. Now, the early community began as a group of wanderers, of course, but it soon evolved a settled pattern of life, at least during a portion of the year. In northern India, there's a rainy season that arrives during the months of June or July, the monsoon, and it makes the roads, especially, of course, in 4th century BC India, impassable for a group of wandering monks. It's kind of hard to go out on these muddy roads and really do the kind of wandering that you would normally expect to do. So it's important for these monks to find a place where they could settle down during the rainy season for what's called the rain retreat. Sometimes, in the very early texts, they went and they're said to that they went and stayed in caves or even at the base of a big tree. But eventually, especially with supporters like Anathapindika around, it was possible for them to set up established regular dwelling places where they could live during the rainy season. These originally were temporary places. They'd then get up and wander around for the rest of the year and then come back to these places the next year for the rains. But of course, as the community became more complex and more sophisticated, these evolved into regular, settled monastic communities known as viharas, communities in which monks lived all year round and lived an organized and sophisticated life of a group of monastic specialists. And this monastic practice or this monastic institution has, for good or ill, and I think largely for good, been the bearer of Buddhist civilization really from that time to the present. Monasteries have been particularly important, as you may well know, in Tibet. In fact, one of the best places to go to see traditional monastic practice in action would be in one of the great monasteries in Lhasa or in central Tibet. But monastic practice is important in China, Japan, and of course, throughout Southeast Asia. In its heyday, say around the year 600 or 700 of the Common Era in India, the great Buddhist monasteries were extraordinarily sophisticated and complex centers of learning. They were really like modern universities, like what universities are for us today, and they taught not just religious discipline and religious ritual, but a lot of the secular disciplines, literature and the arts, medicine, and so on that were part of the sophisticated and intellectual life of the communities that they were part of. Now, that was, I think, probably something that you would have to mark up on the positive side of the ledger. These monasteries really permitted the development of a kind of sophisticated Buddhist civilization that would have been difficult without them, simply among a small band of wanderers. But also, strangely enough, made the Buddhist community vulnerable to persecution, because if these monasteries were really the major centers of Buddhist life, if public support for the monasteries began to wane, or if in more problematic circumstances you had a group of invaders coming in whose job, or who took their job to be the suppression of practice of monasticism like this, they were extremely vulnerable to persecution. And that eventually is what happened in India. During the 11th and 12th centuries, there were a series of invasions that swept across northern India from Afghanistan and devastated many of the sophisticated cultural institutions in northern India. And one of the major focal points of persecution was this group of monasteries strung down along the Ganges basin and on into the region that is now Bihar and Bengal. And when they were suppressed, when they were burned and destroyed and the monks were dispersed, it was very difficult for Buddhism to regenerate in India. So one of the ironies of Buddhist history is that Buddhism has virtually died out, or did virtually die out in that time, in the land of its origin, in India, due at least in part to the vulnerability of these sophisticated monastic institutions. Now, as you trace the history of this community after the Buddha's death and on into that challenging time when the Buddha was no longer around to guide the early community, one of the issues that you need to focus on is the problem of authority. When he was alive, obviously, if you had a dispute, you could go to him and he would sort the dispute out for you and give you, if necessary, a new regulation to deal with whatever the issue was at hand. In his absence, where do you turn? Where do you go to settle any kind of dispute? Early in the day, shortly after the Buddha died, the community banded together and called what's called the First Buddhist Council to recite his teaching and to codify his teaching, to recall it and to codify it so that the Dharma itself, the teaching itself, could be used to resolve disputes. Now, at this gathering at the First Buddhist Council, a disciple by the name of Ananda, who was the Buddha's trusty sidekick and the person who knew him best and was most present with him during many of his teaching situations, recited the Buddha's doctrine, his doctrinal teachings. And these became what's known as the Sutta Pitaka, the basket of doctrinal discourses, a collection of Buddhist doctrine. Another monk by the name of Upali recited the Buddha's rules and regulations. These became the Vinaya Pitaka, or the basket of discipline. And then eventually later, not right at the very beginning, another basket was added to this group of texts called the Abhidhamma that included a body of sophisticated reflection on the categories of the Dharma. These three together constitute the three baskets of Buddhist teaching. It's common to call these three baskets a canon of Buddhist scripture, although they were actually not written down for several centuries after the Buddha's death. So these constitute the scriptural corpus of the Buddhist tradition, and they are, as you might well imagine, quite extensive. If I stacked them up on my rather small podium, they would fall off the ends. So the Buddhist tradition became a scriptural tradition, and we'll see as time goes on in Tibet, China, and Japan, one of the most important things to do as you confront a new situation in many cases is to generate a new scripture, or if barring that, to generate some new commentary and new explanation of older scripture. What are the contents of the Buddhist scriptures? Well, traditional discourses of the Buddha begin with a formula that is clearly drawn from the oral tradition. They always start out, "Thus have I heard. At one time the Buddha was dwelling in such and such a place, and he said such and such a thing." So they reflect, especially in the early suttas, this original oral matrix in which the Buddhist tradition was presented. The old discourses of the Buddha often have a very simple and down-to-earth style that a lot of people find quite attractive, and they present what I think you would have to call is a very pragmatic approach to religious truth. They're concerned about experience and what will be confirmed in experience, not about spinning out all sorts of doctrinal distinctions. The discourse on the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, for example, a discourse that I mentioned when we were talking about the Four Noble Truths, starts out simply by commenting on the middle path. O bhikkhus, O monks, these two extremes ought not to be practiced by those who have gone forth from the household life. What are these two? There's devotion to the indulgence of the senses, which is low and common. And there is devotion to self-mortification, which is painful and unworthy. Avoiding these two extremes, the Buddha has realized the middle path. It gives vision. It gives knowledge. And it leads to calm, to insight, to awakening, to nibbana. And he goes on from there, of course, to give the outline of the Four Noble Truths. And one of the simplest of the early sermons, and in my view, I think one of the most intriguing, and precisely because it seems on the face of it to be so simple and so one-dimensional, is called the Fire Sermon. The Buddha starts out and says this, "Bhikkhus, everything is burning. Everything is burning. And what is it that is burning? Bhikkhus, the eye is burning. Visible forms are burning. Visual consciousness is burning." And so on. And he goes through all of the other senses. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust, with the fire of hate, and the fire of delusion. He goes on then and says each of these things about other categories of Buddhist experience. Now, what I like about this is, I suppose, partly the echo that it produces for me of a good sermon. I don't know if any of you turn on the TV on Sunday morning and just flip through the channels to see who happens to be preaching that day and listen to the cadence of a good preacher's voice. Sometimes preaching is best when it is simplest, and it has a certain kind of rhythmic cadence that repeats the same formula again and again and applies it to different aspects of experience. A part of that is an artifact, obviously, of the oral nature of preaching. It's one of the places in our culture where you can still really hear the oral medium, the human voice at work conveying emotion and truth. This early sermon is like that. I think it grows out of an oral setting, and it conveys its experience with the same kind of repetitive quality that you hear in a good sermon. Another story that is very important for the self-understanding of Buddhists in the modern world is the story of a man named Malunkyaputta. It's called The Story of Malunkyaputta and the Arrow. The story goes like this. Malunkyaputta, a possible convert to The Buddha's Dharma comes to the Buddha and he says, well, you know, Buddha, I really kind of like some of the stuff you're saying, but you know, you haven't answered all the questions for me that I want to have answered. So if you can tell me, and he lists a series of 10 questions, is the world eternal or not? Does it have an origin or not? Is the Buddha going to survive after death or not? If you can answer all those questions for me, then I'll be a convert and join your community. And the Buddha says, well, Malankaputta, you ask me these questions and you kind of remind me of a guy who's just been shot with a poisoned arrow. And you're lying there on the ground. Somebody walks up and offers to pull the arrow out. And you say, wait a minute. Don't pull out that arrow. I want to know, first of all, who shot it? What caste did that person belong to? What kind of bow did he use? What feather is used to guide the arrow? And who made the arrow? And when you tell me the answer to all of those questions, then I'll let you pull the arrow out. I don't remember exactly how Malankaputta responds to this, but the story in the end, I suppose, is being spoken to us as much as to Malankaputta. It's a way of saying, don't be concerned about a lot of doctrinal issues that have to do particularly with the origin of things. What we're concerned about here in the Buddhist tradition is the pragmatic removal of suffering. We want to get that arrow out and not speculate too much about where the arrow came from. We need to know something about its origin in order to remove it, fine. But otherwise, let's focus on the pragmatic issue of removing human suffering. You also find that the tradition is expressed in very simple and memorable verses, as you would expect in an oral tradition. You know, proverbs are one of the ways, of course, that traditional teachings are conveyed religiously, especially in an oral tradition like this. I'll read you a couple of them, just to give you a flavor for what these proverbs sound like. They come from a text called the Dhammapada, or the words of the teaching, one of the very early collections of the Buddha's spoken teaching. Not to do any evil, to cultivate good, and to purify one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So simple. I can hear it being spoken to me by Buddhist monks in Sri Lanka and in Thailand. What is the Buddha's teaching? Don't do evil. Do good and purify your mind. Now, it seems extremely simple, and I suppose if somebody told you, well, what's my teaching? Don't do evil, do good. Well, it's hard to disagree with that, but notice this little added bit at the end. Also purify your mind. That's Buddhist. That's the Buddha speaking. You've got to find some way to purify the mind of ignorance and desire, and then you can really strike at the root of issues of evil and good. So in its simplicity, it also conveys a distinctive message that tells us something about this early community. Another proverb like this, you are your own protector. What other protector can there be? With yourself fully controlled, you obtain a protection that is hard to obtain. Another statement, very simple. We know that Buddhists are self-reliant. We know they're concerned about achieving nirvana for themselves and not depending on others. This seems simply to be an affirmation of that. But this word protector has a little hook in it. It's also the word that you can use to refer to God. So the Buddha is saying here, you are your own God. You are your own God. What other God can there be? With yourself fully controlled, you obtain a protection that is hard to obtain. Strong teaching. Stands the Buddhist tradition up in opposition to much of what was happening in Hindu life at that time. So you get a flavor here, even in the simplicity of the teaching, of some of the distinctive aspects of the teaching of the Buddha. Now, I should close by mentioning one more important institutional development in the history of this early community. This is somewhat problematic to interpret, but it is important for our own consideration of Buddhist history. It's called the Second Buddhist Council. And according to some accounts, it took place about 100 years after the Buddha's death. And it was staged in response, held in response, to an incipient sectarian split within the Sangha. When one group, it seems, wanted to overturn and revise some of the basic stipulations of Buddhist, the Buddhist discipline. Sometimes opposing party is caricatured in a way that seems to attack its moral standing. But at the core of the dispute seems to be some kind of a disagreement about the use of gold and silver and in the carrying of condiments from one day to the next. Some people thought you should be able to adjust the discipline to make this possible, and some thought that you had to stick strictly according to the traditional discipline. Now, out of this split came two parties, the Stavyravadas, or the elder, the doctrine of the elders, who were the conservative party, and the Mahasanghikas, or the great community party, that were the liberals. They split and didn't recognize each other's interpretation of the discipline. Now, out of this split came eventually 18 separate schools of traditional Buddhism and began the process of sectarian division that led eventually to the split between the Mahayana and the traditional forms of discipline that we'll discuss when we come to the Mahayana in a later lecture.